Well, actually, the good thing is that I'll be able to show you some clips from all of those, some of those shows, so I'm not going to talk for the full hour. You'll be very pleased to hear. Pete, thanks very much for the very extensive, you weren't supposed to read all of that, just a couple of lines would have been fine. Ladies and gentlemen, fellow science communicators, it is a great honour to give the keynote address at this year's Science Communicators Association Conference. Thank you on behalf of NHNZ, Natural History New Zealand, for your invitation. I'd also like to thank Horizons Regional Council for making it possible through their sponsorship. And our thanks, my thanks also to Massey University for providing a fantastic venue for this conference. All right, well, I'm going to start with a very basic question, that is, what is a science communicator? And I'd like to start by saying what I believe it is not. It's not a noble calling. We don't worship at the altar of science. We're not high priests handing down the thoughts of scientists to mortals, which I know some people might be tempted to indulge in. What we're doing is we're selling information in a buyer's market. We're competing with hundreds and thousands of media sources for our audience's attention. And that's tough, particularly these days in a market which seems to be increasingly dominated by personality and opinion rather than journalism. Harder still, we're working with a tough brand to market, and that is science. A word that unfortunately can carry negative connotations for some people. For many who struggled with it at school, it triggers a reaction of, I didn't get it then, and I won't get it now. Science, even more than economics, is a subject people find difficult. They're suspicious of science, what scientists do, and what benefits they bring to society. And we can see that reflected in our parliamentary representatives, the people who make the critical decisions about money for research and our strategies and policies for the future. Out of curiosity, I asked our publicist to check the tertiary qualifications of all the listed MPs. Of 122, 57, almost half, have liberal arts degrees. 26 have a science degree. 10 have a commerce or business degree. 12 have no tertiary qualifications. And the rest didn't provide any information. So, 1 in 5 has a science degree. Most of the rest are probably like me. I was a typical liberal arts graduate who, if they thought of scientists at all, it was as the cliched, white-coated boffin with a clipboard in the James Bond movies. At university, they were the poor buggers who actually had to work hard and go to lectures, while the arts guys mucked around and had fun. While they were discovering atoms and molecules, we were writing poetry and discovering ourselves. Science and technology were invisible, like dark matter. All this invisible stuff that held the universe and my life together. But I didn't know how or why. I didn't really care. It just did. You plugged in the stereo, turned it on, and you got music. Great. How? Darned if I knew. But anyway, eventually I got to be a science communicator, or reporter as I was called in those days, in 1987 on a television science show called Quantum, produced by the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. I'd been a journalist in current affairs for 9 years, but I soon found out that telling science stories is quite a challenge. Most of what you're describing is unpronounceable, invisible, or too far away to see. And it doesn't move a lot. Not great qualities for television. And the stories are often inconclusive, which is why many of them ended with those immortal words, only time will tell. That actually became such a cliche that on some of the programs I worked on, it was eventually banned. I learned that science is an endless journey. Stories have endings. Science does not. But in spite of all that, I became totally hooked. Here was a world I never knew about. A fractal world of infinite complexity and never-ending possibilities. It was like stepping into a parallel universe. The great thing about telling science stories is the chance to time travel. because almost every story takes you either back in time or into the future. I'm going to show you now a short clip from a quantum show called Big Time for Little Machines. This is about micro machinery and nanotechnology. And it was done nearly 20 years ago. I apologize for the image quality. It is unfortunately off VHS, which happens to be the only format I still have it on. And we hopefully go. Should be that one there. No? Peter and I have this all absolutely masterminded, techno glitches. Tell me how I. No?
Melding this microscope with incredible precision, Jonathan Lehman has created the tiniest map in the world. The scale is an impressive 10 trillion to 1. Each of these dots is a minute mountain of a few thousand gold atoms deposited from the microscope's tip. But what's the point of this molecular cartography?
Well, I think the major driving force is very clear. It's computer technology. Computer technology has, for the last 50 years, been getting better. Every year, smaller, faster, cheaper. And we're beginning to say, how can we keep this up? How can we continue to get more, better, faster every year, year after year after year, for the next 20 years or the next 30 years? And the answer is very clear, because the device sizes are going to be down in the molecular size range.
If a molecular nanotechnology was able to cluster atoms to represent bits of information, we could fit the equivalent of 24 million books into a space no bigger than a speck of dust.
Oh no, here we go.
The term nanotechnology was coined by California futurist Eric Drexler in his remarkable book, Engines of Creation. The name is very apt because the dimensions are measured not in micrometers, but in nanometers. That's billionths of a meter. Well, the world that Drexler describes in this book here is vastly different from the one we inhabit now.
It's a world where the factory floor is too small to see, where the construction machinery has a programmable intelligence like DNA. A technological revolution as significant as a leap straight from the Stone Age to the Space Age.
So there we go. That was nanotechnology back in about 1991. In fact, actually, this month is the 20th anniversary of when Don Igler, an IBM researcher, first manipulated a single atom and created, spelt out the letters IBM using individual atoms using a scanning tunneling microscope. I was lucky enough to actually go and film with him, and I think I was the sixth person in the world to move an atom. Cool. Hey. I don't know if the world changed, but there you go. The cool thing about telling science stories is you are in the nose cone of the time machine. There we were talking about nanotechnology back in 1991. And it's a technology that is still evolving. Already it is changing our world in ways most of us aren't even aware of. But 20 years ago, in those heady days on quantum, we were a bit on the mission. We were there to celebrate science and technology. And it seemed as if the audience's appetite for pure and applied science was unbounded. We could and did do shows on supernovae, gravity waves, string theory, and nanotechnology. But times changed. As we headed through the 90s, when I was on Beyond 2000, the internet began to have a significant impact on the world. I suspect there are people here who thought, you mean there was a time before the internet? Yes, there was a time before the internet. Well, in quantum, we had one computer for an entire production in the late 1980s. And anyway, so the internet came in the early 90s in terms of being applied across the world and in television programs. I felt the tide of gravity attract our information-seeking audience away from television and towards the online universe. It seemed as if life was accelerating and people's time was becoming more precious. They didn't have as much brain space for soaking up information from TV. TV was for entertainment. So the networks reacted by going, hey, we got to make science shows more like music video clips. Let's make MTV science. Which takes me to my next clip from a series called Ultra Science that Peter mentioned, made by Beyond Productions in Sydney for the Learning Channel, who wanted their shows to be cool, sexy, and fast-paced. The topic is time travel. Again, I apologise for the VHS quality, and this time also the burnt-in time code.
Take the ultimate trip, a journey through time. Burst into the future, leap into the past. Scientists thought it couldn't be done, but maybe they were wrong.
Notice the past is in black
Think
and white.
About it. You can go back billions of years and see the solar system form. You can see life begin on Earth. You can see the pyramids being built. You can visit the crucifixion.
It used to be considered pure fantasy. But remarkable developments in science are bringing us closer than ever to pushing through the barriers of time, leaping from one century to another, from anywhere to anywhere. It's something most scientists argued could never be done, but others clung to the dream and continued searching for ways to somehow, someday, break through the barrier of time.
It's a feedback between science fiction and science reality. Almost anything you can imagine in science fiction is starting to come true today.
We haven't quite got to time travel, but, you know, science works slowly. A couple of cheats, you'll notice there's some very cool CG in there, which we managed to pinch off an ad. It was a very cool ad running on Australian TV at the time. We managed to persuade them by sleight of hand that they should allow us to use it. These days we wouldn't get away with it. So as you can see, we let our imaginations go a little wild, and we had a lot of fun. And that is a vital element in telling science stories. I like to think of the role of a science communicator as a time-travelling tour guide. Someone who's taking their audience on a virtual tour of the past and the future. They're fascinated by the subject, they're informed, enthusiastic, entertaining, and above all, they are great storytellers. Because whichever part of the science communication business you're in today, you've got to grab and hold people's attention. And the best way to do that is with a story. Which brings me to the present and the extraordinary achievements of NHNZ. I'm assuming most of you know who we are, but not perhaps what we are. NHNZ is a Dunedin-based production company employing around 110 people, a mix of staff and contractors. We're owned by Fox International Channels, who are headquartered in Europe. And who are backing our expansion, which I'll tell you a bit more about in a moment. We make around 50 hours of factual TV every year. That's about 475 hours over the past 10 years. Most of what we produce contains an element, at least, of science. And under that heading, I include natural history, engineering, and technology. Our clients include National Geographic channels, Discovery, the Science Channel, Animal Planet, Travel Channel, Discovery Asia, A&E Television Networks, France 5, and Japanese broadcaster NHK. Since becoming independent from TVNZ in 1997, NHNZ has developed a purely commercial business model, which means our company's survival is governed entirely by our skills and success at making and selling programs. What that means is the content of our programs and the style in which they are presented are entirely client, audience, and ultimately ratings driven. It's a demanding, unforgiving, and often fickle environment. I was explaining earlier on to Peter how, you know, in the old, good old days, you'd go, hey, let's make a documentary about, the pyramid, time travel, whatever it is. You go and make it, and then you take it out in the market and see if, try and find a buyer. Nowadays, that is completely turned upside down. The market is so driven by niche audiences, by demographics, by advertising revenue, that 99% of the time, all our productions are pre-sold. Everything is cleared with the broadcaster. We discuss it in great detail. So it is a totally different world. You cannot make documentaries on spec. And that does have an influence on what we make. But there's no magic formula for what makes good TV. We have a development team constantly seeking out new ideas, writing up proposals and pitching them to the networks. But this is an inexact science. The strike rate is low, about 10%. That's a universal figure common across the industry. So you can imagine how many ideas we have to come up with to make our 50 hours of television each year. The research and development costs are significant. But if we didn't make that commitment in time and resources to our development unit, NHNZ would go out of business fast. New ideas are the lifeblood of what we do. But it's not just ideas, it's how those ideas are given shape and form, how they're instilled with character and drama, how they're woven into stories that compel and intrigue. That is at the heart of our science and our storytelling. The best way to give you a sense, I think, yes, another clip, of what kinds of stories we tell and what appeals to our international clients and their audiences is to show you just a few clips from some shows we've made in recent times.
Something never seen before. The capture of a live colossal squid. For marine biologist Steve O'Shea, it's a dream come true. Team of experts have 3 days to study the squid and keep it from decaying. It won't be easy. And it won't be pretty. As they take the world's first look inside this monster of the deep. The tallest TV tower on Earth with a super slim waist. Some called it a blueprint for disaster.
There's some expert argument. Theodoros. There we are, correct?
But others have the courage to see it through.
It was like now or never, so we just had to go for it.
Take on a challenge like none other. Doing business in the 21st century.
We're at 37,000 feet and just into the earth. It was just incredible. I couldn't believe we could hit that hard and still have all of our parts connected.
It was chaos, bodies being thrown about, some still strapping their chairs, others thrown from their chairs, smoke, fire.
It was pure terror. It was pure terror.
So, you see, quite a selection of stuff we do, and not all natural history by any means. In fact, that last one, Paul Bayer Survived, is, we're now just about to go into our fourth series. That's called the Bio Channel in the United States, and it's broken all records. It's been one of their highest rating shows ever. All done from New Zealand, where it filmed, of course, in America. But look, there are several clues in that reel which are key to New Zealand, NHNZ's success. Firstly, you'll notice we don't just do natural history, and that's an important survival lesson. We've adapted to the changing needs and the demands of the international market. And secondly, you'll see that our tagline is a world of stories. That's because we are telling stories, not just presenting information. We look for challenges and drama because they're valuable storytelling tools. We engage people's emotions. We want them to care. We look for strong characters, people who are passionate about what they do, because that passion is infectious and projects through the TV screen. Our storytelling style is conversational, so people feel comfortable watching. They're not held at arm's length by jargon, the kind of thing that Sue was talking about earlier on, dense prose or convoluted language. So, what makes a good or great science story? The unusual, the mysterious, the unexplained, the monumental. And science is full of all of those things. And the excitement of a challenge or a test with an unexpected or unpredictable outcome, commonly known as scientific research. Sometimes you get lucky. So, the colossal squid, which you saw a clip from there before, quite a great story. A hideous sea monster hauled up from the depths of the ocean in the remote Antarctic. Unbeatable. That story was almost perfect. There was footage of the catch. We had access and full cooperation from Te Papa, who were doing a scientific analysis of the squid. We had a world expert on colossal squid here in New Zealand, Dr. Steve O'Shea, who we'd worked with before and who is a great science communicator. And we had a succession of cliffhangers. Had the squid survived the freezing process? Would it survive the thaw? Was it as big as originally estimated? Answer, no. Great for our story, the classic moment of disappointment for the scientists. Was it a male? They desperately wanted a boy. But no, it was a girl. But look what big eyes it had. And best of all, there was a ticking clock, counting down to a deadline. They only had so many hours to examine the squid before it started to go off. And we all know that if seafood goes off, it really goes off. The Commissioning Network Discovery Channel in the US wanted us to mount a webcast to boost anticipation. So the scientific investigation was played live onto the web, and that succeeded beyond expectations. Our webcast video was the 9th most popular click in the US on Wednesday, the 30th of April 2008. The story made the front page of the New York Times, and BBC Online said it was the most popular story in the world that week. So perhaps not surprisingly, when the show aired on Discovery in August, it rated its socks off. And the entire show, the scientific examination, the program research, content, location, experts, production, post-production, all came out of New Zealand. So, why do we approach our stories this way? Are we trying to dumb things down? Are we scared of being serious about science? Absolutely not. But we are storytellers working in a particular market. And that market is unbelievably competitive, and it is entertainment driven. We must entertain our audience. Otherwise, they will not watch. You can entertain and inform, but with a mass market, you won't inform if you cannot or won't entertain. That doesn't mean that we abandon scientific accuracy or that we make things up. International science documentaries for the US networks are among the most closely scrutinized and fact-checked media reports in the business. For example, both National Geographic channels and Discovery Channel require us to annotate all our scripts. National Geographic have an entire department called Standards and Practices, whose sole task is to check, query, and test the accuracy of every fact in every program they commission or co-produce. To give you an example of how thorough that process is, a normal script for a one-hour documentary runs to around 30 pages. An annotated script with all the queries answered, evidence and citations quoted, can run to between 100 and 200 pages. The longest annotated script was for an episode in a series we finished this year called Bite Me with Dr. Mike. Yes, we'll see a clip in a moment. And that was 222 pages long, which currently holds the record. Unbelievable. We actually have to hire people onto our programs whose sole job is to annotate, to find the sources to support every single fact. So while you digest that thought and the incredible amount of work that it entails, here's a clip from the show. We made this series for Travel Channel in the US and National Geographic Channel International. It features an Oxford-trained virologist, Dr. Mike Leahy, whose mission is to travel the world and check out as many small, biting, disease-carrying bugs and parasites as he can find. And whenever it's safe and possible, Dr. Mike gets bitten in the name of science.
I'm going to show you just how easily you can fall foul of the fire ants. Gentlemen, start your engines. I'm about to enter a world of pain. These are the Brazilian fire ants. You can see they're around my big toe. They're tiny, but they're excruciatingly painful. They're called fire ants for a reason. And it doesn't so much feel like being bitten as being set on fire. Because first they bite you with their mandibles or mouthpieces, which are barbed. And I guess that's the first thing you feel. Then they arch their back over and they sting you with a very powerful alkaloid venom. And it feels like I'm on fire. These ants are so tiny and they're really well hidden in the grass. You're just walking along, put your foot down on what looks like an ordinary piece of ground, and in minutes they swarm on you. Oh, I don't know why you're laughing. They're up your leg too. And they're complex venom. And in rare cases, even death.
Before we go to the next clip. At that point, something went wrong. Now, in science communication, particularly in television, something going wrong is a double-edged sword. And you'll find out why in a minute.
Sounds right. Right, yeah. I thought that those fire ants were just going to burn a bit and were just going to hurt a bit, but this is an example of a real good reaction to a fire ant sting. For a start, look at my arms, they've come up. Like, they got warts all over them. Can you see it spreading as well? Huge blisters. My lips come up. My heart's beating very, very fast. See my eyelid? My left eye is starting to close because my eyelid's swollen. And I can feel my tongue swelling as well. My heartbeat's going really, really fast. You can't see that. But I'm also having a bit of trouble breathing, so yeah, I think next stop is medical attention. I've got the anti-histamines, like powerful ones, quite close by. My film crew and now my lifeline, and they rush me to the nearest hospital. As I struggle for breath, the clock is now ticking.
So, So there's always a risk, of course, in exposing yourself to being bitten by nasty, bitey things. What none of us knew, including Dr. Mike, was that he was allergic to fire ant venom. Apparently the likelihood of that is something like 1%. It's one in 100. But luckily, we were filming near a Brazilian medical facility. Otherwise, the consequences could have been very serious, possibly fatal for Mike, which wouldn't have been good for him at all. And it wouldn't have been good for us, since that was the first episode. It would have broken an unwritten rule of television, which happens to be the same rule for parasites, and that is, never kill your host. So Bite Me is a great example of how you can make fun. Oh, by the way, I should say Mike obviously did survive, and we went on to complete the series, thankfully, which is currently being streamed around the world. So Bite Me is a great example of how you can make fun, entertaining, and informative science TV by weaving your stories around a strong character who is passionate about what they do, and by creating what the networks call an immersive experience. That was an immersive experience, which is another way of saying it gets the host and the audience involved in an emotional way with the subject matter. And that is what it's all about, because if you get your audience involved, they watch and they stay watching. And you, as communicators, are succeeding. If you don't have an audience, you have failed. And in our business, failure to communicate really is not an option. All right, a bit of background about NHNZ. So what is our market? Most of NHNZ's programs are produced for the American market. The US television industry is the most competitive in the world. It is second to none in terms of size and influence. The US boasts some 104 million cable TV subscribers, that's homes. That's 90% of all homes in the United States. And they select from an average of around 120 channels. The good news for NHNZ is that television watching is actually on the rise in the US. At the end of last year, the average American watched around 142 hours of TV per month. Five more than they watched the previous year. The other good news for NHNZ is that the American audience has a natural curiosity for science and technology. They like to know what's new and how stuff works. In fact, there's a show on Discovery Channel called Just That, How Stuff Works, based on a website of the same name. You may come across it. And on the Science Channel, they have a series called How It's Made. That shows everything from chainsaws to slot machines and how they're designed and manufactured. Not my kind of TV, but that's not the point. What it shows is an inherent curiosity about the mechanics of the world they live in. Americans are curious people, in many ways. They are fascinated by process, by technology, and by how things work. A current hit on the History Channel is How the Earth Was Made, a series about geological processes that have shaped our planet. A hit series about geology? Who could have predicted that? Well, fortunately, NHNZ did. We are currently in production on a major two-hour special for a US and an international network on what our world will be like 250 million years from now. Now, unfortunately, I can't tell you any more about it, and I can't show you a clip because it's still being filmed, because it's a commissioned show, and it will have spectacular computer graphics. We're working with Weta Productions in Wellington, as well as stunningly designed props, all made in Dunedin. It's going to be an absolute cracker, so look out for that one. You'll probably be able to watch it on Sky. Alright, I'm going to move on from how stuff works to another aspect of this. And that fascination with how stuff works lies behind the success of a popular subject which makes up a significant percentage of NHNZ's output, and that's engineering. We've done two series of a show called Man-Made Marvels for Discovery Asia, featuring engineering projects throughout the Asian region. We've filmed more than a dozen of these in Malaysia, China, South Korea, Japan, Singapore, Taiwan, and Macau. We've also done 5 engineering shows for National Geographic's immensely popular series, Megastructure. And we currently have another 3 in production. So to give you a clip, I don't know if you're Megastructure watchers or if you've ever seen it, but here's a clip of one of our top rating shows we did for Megastructure about the Shanghai World Financial Center.
Take 60,000 tons of steel, 260,000 cubic meters of concrete, 2,000 dedicated Chinese workers, and some of the best design brains in the business. And this is what you get. The Shanghai World Financial Center, nearly 500 meters tall, and every meter state of the art. Designed to be strong enough to stand up to killer typhoons and powerful earthquakes, and to withstand the ultimate threat by a world-renowned engineer still haunted by his most famous building's horrifying fate.
I don't think I ever got through the experience of 9/11.
When this megastructure's finished, the world will marvel at a skyscraper like no other. A dazzling icon of China's rise to power.
To what make a great science story are all there. A dramatic story arc with cliffhangers and strong characters who battle the odds and are passionate about what they're doing. The science payoff is you actually learn a lot about engineering principles, cyclone and earthquake protection, fire safety, lift design, bridge design, monster machines, and the people who operate them. In other words, about the infrastructure that supports much of our industrial world and our lifestyle. And that is just as much a part of science communication. Okay, I'm just going to briefly tell you a little bit about NHNZ, just a bit of background here. Being successful in our field has not come easily. We've had to work hard at it, but there are 3 characteristics about the company and its leadership under Michael Stedman which have proved critical. Sensing the future, being adaptable, and taking risks. NHNZ is here today because the company realised 12 years ago that natural history films, which had been its foundation and core business, were losing traction in the market. The market was saturated. So the company decided to expand its genres to include science, medicine, people, and adventure. It was a smart move, and not just because that's when they hired me, but because the world was changing, and many of those companies that chose to ignore the warning signs are now extinct. As those of you familiar with the principles of evolution will know, specialists are successful as long as the environment stays the same. Change the environment or add something new to it, and specialists run the risk of finding their specialization being their Achilles heel. Just ask a Kiwi. Which is why NHNZ maintains a constant vigilance in relation to its markets. Now I'm just going to confer briefly with Peter because I am running over here and I'd like to show you some more of what we do. So I'm going to jump to a little more, just a bit about, I think I'm going to go to the Weird Edens thing, if that's alright. I'll just read the bit before. So how I've described NHNZ as it is today may be a surprise to many of you. New Zealanders who think they know NHNZ probably still think of us as a blue chip natural history filmmaker. But that's just one part of our business today. And what we make is very different to traditional wildlife shows. Our biggest budget and most ambitious series right now is one called Weird Edens. That's its working title, but in fact it is indicative of the changing world of natural history shows. In fact, it's not a natural history series, it's a science series about evolution that focuses on 6 different parts of the world and asks, how on earth did the strange creatures that inhabit those places get there? And how did they get to be so weird? The brief from our international co-producers is quite clear. They want new surprising images, high technology, and how big geological and climatic events shaped evolution. Sounds great. classic wish list statements, but they carry a lot of subtext. That wish list is in reality an expectation list, and it signifies the enormous pressure on companies like NHNZ to deliver at the peak of what the market wants, and preferably above and beyond that. So, in order to meet the expectations, NHNZ has invested significantly this year in a high-definition phantom camera worth over $400,000 that shoots at 1,000 frames per second. This camera allows our crews to capture amazingly detailed imagery, as you're about to see in slow motion. This is just 30 seconds long. No sound. Hope you can see it clearly. So this is a Kia shaping water off.